For those of you who don't know me, I'm Chris Foster. I'm president of the Free Software Society, and I thank you for coming today. We are absolutely, completely honored to have the executive director of the Free Software Foundation, an active member in the software development community, and the boss of the Free Software bosses, pretty much, Mr. Bradley Kuhn.
So, this talk is probably different than most of the talks that happen here in any kind of academic setting. It tends to be the case that in computer science and in the sciences in general, people tend to avoid political and ethical issues surrounding the field. And in the free software community, for decades now, we have focused on the ethical and political implications of software. These days, a lot of people focus on how the software that our movement produced, the free software that exists in Body today and GNU plus Linux systems or the various BSD systems that are available, they think about it in terms of its reliability, its dependability, and how functional it is. But we continue in the free software movement to focus on the ethical and political implications of the software and what rights people have. In fact, we believe that the issues of technology and how good technology is and how functional it is are ultimately secondary to the questions of what kind of community is surrounding that software. And we focus on the idea of augmenting the community of software users and programmers and fostering cooperation and goodwill between programmers and users alike. And that continues to be the issue we focus most on. What I want to demonstrate to you tonight through some personal anecdotes, through some philosophical consideration, and through a little bit of historical perspective about the movement is to show you how free software can build and create cooperating communities of software developers and users, and how, by direct contrast, proprietary software, the functional opposite of free software, tears down and impedes the creation of cooperating communities. Unfortunately, because English has a bug in it, I have to start by defining terms. It's always unfortunate when you have to start a conversation by defining your terms, but this is because while English has more than any other words, more words than any other language on the planet, it still has only one adjective for two very different concepts. When we're talking about free software, we're talking about free as in freedom, not necessarily price. So think about free speech, not free beer. I know that's hard for college students to think about and avoid the free beer aspect of what we do. But for the evening, I hope you'll focus on the ideas of free speech rather than free handouts or free beer. Other languages, of course, make this distinction clear. In Spanish, there's the adjective libre and the adjective gratis, which are referring to these two different types of free. We don't have that in English, unfortunately. So free software is defined in terms of what freedoms you, a particular user, receive with the software. And it's always defined in the context of specific users, because a given software system could be free software for one person, and the exact same system might not be free as in freedom for another person. The first freedom that you as a user get with free software is the freedom to run and use the program for any particular purpose that you can think of. This includes any purpose that the original programmer who wrote the software or the original distributor of the software might not even have considered. This freedom is often these days restricted even with proprietary software. It used to be the case that all software, by and large, gave you this freedom. But these days, you can get versions, for example, of Microsoft FrontPage that forbid you from creating web pages with it that say negative things about Microsoft. So even that freedom to run and use the program for any purpose doesn't exist sometimes with proprietary software. With free software, you always get that right. You can use the software for anything you can think of, including exercising your free speech rights to say how much you hate the Free Software Foundation or something like that. The second freedom that you get is the freedom to help yourself by improving, changing, modifying, or otherwise adapting the software to suit your own needs. And of course, if you are a software programmer, you can take direct benefit from this freedom because you understand how software works and you can look at the software's source code, which, by the way, is a prerequisite for this freedom, because even making the most trivial adaptations or modifications to computer software without its source code, the original stuff the programmer generated, is virtually impossible. So all free software, by prerequisite, has to come with the source code so that you can modify that source code to improve the software to suit your needs. This freedom, as I've said, directly benefits programmers, but it also indirectly benefits non-programmers, people who don't know how to write software. This is because they are allowed to ask anyone they want to modify or adapt the software on their behalf. And an interesting thing comes up with regard to free software in this case. You have this same freedom whether you choose to exercise it in a non-commercial sense or in a commercial sense. So if you're a software user but not a programmer, and you have a free software program that doesn't work quite right for you, it has a bug or is missing a feature that you need, you can ask a friend as an altruistic act to improve or fix the software for you. But you can also, if you can't convince a friend of yours to fix it without paying them, you can hire anyone you'd like on the competitive free market to fix the software. You can hire someone to do the work for you. So this freedom and all the other freedoms I'm going to talk about always work in both a non-commercial and a commercial sense. And the free software licenses that we've produced and ones that we've approved as things we think are free software licenses make sure that the non-commercial and the commercial freedoms are treated equally, that you have an equal right to make money from free software and you have equal right to engage in various activities non-commercially. The third freedom that you get is the freedom to help other people by sharing your software. This, again, can be done altruistically or as part of a business model. You can share free software if your friend sees you running a copy of a free program. You can give them a copy and make a copy immediately for them and distribute it to them. All free software licenses give you this right. But you also have the freedom to go into the commercial business of sharing software. We have a specific name in our economic culture for commercial sharing of software. It's usually called distribution or putting software for sale. With free software, you can charge any price you would like. If you can get people to pay you that price for the software, you're permitted to sell it at that price. You can, of course, put it for sale at any price you like, but you may not get an opportunity to sell a copy of GCC for $1 million, although Monte Vista seems to be able to get $15,000 a copy for the same stuff you can download for our website. So there is substantial money that you can make from distributing free software. Red Hat, for example, early in their business model, made a lot of money selling copies of distributions of GNU Linux, especially before high-speed connections were common among their user base. They were able to sell box sets for around $40 or $50. And that price was set by what the market would bear and what they felt they could get for it. Free software has no requirements on you about how much or how little you can charge for distribution. So that's your third freedom, your freedom to help other people by sharing the software. The fourth and final key freedom that you get with free software is the freedom to help the community at large, effectively by combining the previous two freedoms. If you modify or adapt a free software program to suit your needs, you have the right, if it's free software, to then distribute that modified or improved version to other people if you'd like. Again, this can be done in an altruistic way or as a commercial endeavor. A lot of free software gets developed by people posting a patch to a mailing list, a discussion list about the development of a particular software program, and encouraging the original developers to include that patch or improvement into the typical version of the software. And incrementally, the software gets better by people altruistically contributing changes. But that's not the only way you can help your community. You can also go into business, selling your services as someone who can modify or improve free software or adapt it to suit the needs of your clients. So that's again, a very important aspect that I really can't stress enough, that commercial and non-commercial endeavors are treated as fully equal by free software licenses. If it's free software, you have both a non-commercial and a commercial right to copy, share, modify, and redistribute the software as much as you'd like. Now, by contrast, you can define proprietary software, which is the term we use for the opposite of free software, as software that restricts most or all of these freedoms. As I mentioned, sometimes the freedom to run or use the program is often restricted by various licensing terms that prohibit you from doing certain things with the software. The freedom to modify or improve the software is usually restricted in two different ways with proprietary software. First, the licensing agreement that you're required to sign or agree to upon opening the package, a legally dubious tactic, by the way, might say you are not permitted to modify or reverse engineer this software to figure out how it works. But they also put a very practical constraint on your ability to modify or improve the software. Software is a very special kind of copyrighted work in our culture. Most copyrighted works, in fact, pretty much all other copyrighted works except for software, come in their transparent form. Until the days when we have chips in our brain that you can download a whole novel or a motion picture into your head, you actually have to experience the piece of literature or the motion picture up on the screen in its form actually presented under copyright. So if you read a novel, even if it's by William Faulkner and very dense, you actually get to see the words, word by word, that composes the literary work. If you go to see a film, even if it's directed by David Lynch, and completely bizarre and you can't figure out, you at least get to see frame by frame and sound by sound what the image and what the vision is, even if it's as warped as that. So you always get, in other copyrighted works, presented with the material itself. Not so with software. When a proprietary software company presents their software to you, you get it only in the form that the computer can understand, the binary ones and zeros that execute to make the program act. You don't actually get the true copyrighted, originally produced work as you do with when you get a copy of a motion picture, or when you get a copy of a musical song, or when you get a copy of a novel. That original work, in fact, under copyright, is the source code of the software. But because computer software has this special thing where, by and large, it needs to be compiled into a binary in some form, or into a bytecode of some form before it can be executed by the computer, they can distribute to you only those binary or bytecode compiled versions of the software and not distribute the source code to you. So they have, of course, the licensing restriction against reverse engineering and trying to figure out how the software works, but they also have this practical constraint that really is a happenstance of the way software happens to work. It's almost by historical accident that you only get the binaries of software and not the source code. It's just the way software happens to work. Now, of course, your freedom to help others is severely restricted because the licensing agreement that you have to agree to prohibits you from sharing. You immediately have to agree upon opening a package of a proprietary software program that you're not going to help anyone else by sharing the copy with them, even though it's zero marginal cost to make a copy and just takes a little bit of electricity and some hard drive space. So that freedom to help others by sharing is restricted with proprietary software, again, by the licensing terms. And of course, since you have neither of those two freedoms, you don't have the freedom to help the community by sharing improved versions by the nature of not having the source code, not having the licensing permission to do these things. So I've laid out these two different worlds of free software and proprietary software and how the rights that you get are set up in each of the worlds. And I haven't really shown you yet at all why these particular freedoms are important. In our society, we frequently give up what some so-called freedom because there's just no reason for us to have that particular, quote, freedom, unquote, and society gains some benefit from us not having it. For example, we don't have the, quote, freedom, unquote, in our society to drive an automobile in any direction we want, at any speed we want, at any time we want, on any road we want. We've decided as a culture that those aren't really freedoms that are of any consequence. that it's a much better society when we have stop signs and stop lights and traffic laws, because the safety of the people is more important than a particular driver's right to speed down the road at any speed, ignoring all stop signs and stop lights and so forth. So we've decided as a culture that that thing, driving any direction you want at any speed you want at any time you want, isn't something that matters. And we've decided as a society we're just going to give that up and let it go. So when I look at this question of why these freedoms are important, I look at it from the terms of what harm is caused by not having these freedoms. If you don't have the right to do those things that I laid out you're allowed to do with free software, who is hurt, and in what way are they hurt? And a lot of you, I think, who are probably my age or younger, you know, I'm 30, and 30 or younger, grew up in this age where we have both free software around and proprietary software around. You probably all heard of GNU plus Linux, although you probably heard it under the name Linux. You probably even used it in one of your classes and so forth. And you probably also used the stuff from the monopolist down the block that is available to you under some licensing term, and you probably haven't thought about this question at all, I would guess. I certainly didn't as I entered my career, and I was really skeptical about these ideas of freedom that I read about on the FSF's webpage and so forth. And I actually spent 14 years of my career thinking about the question, and I actually came to the same conclusion that the founders of our organization did in the end, because of specific experiences that I had in the industry that began to show me that there was real harm caused by proprietary software and by the practice of propagating proprietary software in our information technology industry. And this 14-year journey begins for me when I got my first computer. I got a computer that probably by this time you guys remember only as an antique, a Commodore 64. Was my first computer. The older people in the crowd seem to know what that is, but the younger people might not. That's just things you download ROMs for, right, in these days. And it didn't come with a whole lot of software. It had BASIC that was burned onto the ROM chip in the computer, so you got the BASIC programming language with it, or Commodore's version of BASIC, at least. And if you wanted more software, you had to get some peripheral device to plug into the machine. So the first thing I got was a little tape deck that you actually had a tape deck that you record programs on, which took forever to load a program, take hours to load a single game or something, you know, it seemed like hours. I was, of course, 10 years old at the time, so anything seemed like hours if it was more than 5 minutes. And I got sick of that, so my parents finally bought me the 1541 floppy drive unit, which was about that long and that high and probably that wide, something like that. It was pretty big device. It weighed more than my laptop sitting over there does now. But it was, in some sense, a portable device. You could carry it under your arm, at least. It's a little bit heavy. So I got this 1541 floppy drive, and so I started looking for software, and all the software was available, you know, in the store if you could get it. But I found there was a lot of other people who had Commodore 64s, and I went to this club in my neighborhood for Commodore 64 users, and I found other kids my age who also had a Commodore 64 and a 1541 floppy drive, and we started to hang out together. And at our age, you know, 10, 11 years old, we didn't see the computer as anything different than the rest of our toys. So we had an attitude about the machine and the programs for it that were very similar to the attitudes our parents had instilled in us regarding how to deal with our toys. And there was two key rules that went around my neighborhood about how you ought to play with your toys. The first rule was that you should always share your toys. You should always make sure that everybody got a turn, that nobody was left out and didn't have a turn to play with the best action figure or the best ship in the action figures universe or whatever. You made sure everybody got a turn to play with the toys in equal measure. The second thing we were supposed to do, and this was a really big deal when I was a kid, was we were supposed to invent games that could include everybody's toys. And this was a particular problem because at the time, Star Wars figures were probably the largest selling toy. But there was also a whole set of knockoffs of generic universe space action figures. And they were about half the price of Star Wars figures, so the kids whose parents didn't have as much money in the neighborhood bought them the, you know, generic space universe action figure, and the kids who had a little bit more money got the real Star Wars official Galoob rubber-stamped versions of Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader and so forth. And there was this big argument in my community about, you know, playing with the kids who didn't have the real action figures. And our parents were always saying, well, you got to play with those kids too and let them be part of your group even though you have different action figures. So this rule was developed that you tried to include everybody's toys and make sure that everybody's toys could come into play in the particular thing you were doing. So here we are with our computers, and we treat them fundamentally the same way, and we found both rules applied. First of all, we found that everybody could get a turn because there was a really neat thing you could do. If you took two of these 1541 floppy drives and you plugged one into the other and ran a cable through the Commodore 64 unit, you could make copies of pretty much any disk that you had. So every game that we had could be copied, and we could share it with all of our friends. And we discovered that we were actually engaged in this sharing activity, and it was a lot easier than it was with single physical object toys because you didn't have to pass them around to take turns. Everybody got a copy. You could play the game together, and you could all go home and play it separately as well. So that rule fit well with what we were doing with our computers. Of course, the second rule by proxy fit, because to actually make these copies, you had to bring your 1541 drive over to someone's house. You couldn't make the copies by yourself. You needed two disk drives to actually get it done at any speed. You didn't want to flop disks all the time, swap them back and forth. So you bring your 1541 drive over to make copies of disks. You'd invented a game that included everybody's toys, and everybody got to share. Our parents actually discovered we played a lot nicer with our computers than we did with our Star Trek toys, or Star Wars toys. So everything seemed to work out okay, and it was going okay for a few months. And then we started to discover that not everybody had the same philosophy about sharing that we did. I discovered this one month when I went to the Commodore 64 Club, and one of the adults in the club, there were a few as it turned out, was presenting a video game that she had just gotten called Little Computer People. And it was this little person that lived inside your computer, and you had to take care of them and deliver their newspaper and make sure they got fed every day, and you had to feed their dog as well. And the coolest part about the game for me at the age of 10 was that it remembered the last time you ran the game by checking the system clock. And if you took a while to run it, the little person would complain at you that you hadn't been by to visit in a long time, and they were wondering what the news was and so forth. This was just the greatest game I'd ever seen. She did a little demo of how she played it and so forth, and we met her little person that she was taking care of in her computer. And I went up afterwards and said, Evelyn, this is the best game I've ever seen. Can I please get a copy so I can play it at home? And her eyes darted a little bit. And my first thought was maybe she didn't have time that day to make the copy because there wasn't a bunch of drives around to do it. And I said, look, if you're too busy today, my parents can drive me over to your house tomorrow. It's Saturday, and we can hook up the drives. It only takes a few minutes, and I can get a copy. And she still didn't want to do it. So I, like 10-year-olds tend to do, I kept pressuring her, asking her, could you please get me a copy of this game? And finally she looked at me and said, I can't make a copy for you. It's illegal. And this was kind of strange to me. And I started describing to her that my friends did this all the time, and it was no big deal, and it couldn't possibly be illegal. After all, you know, the police never came over our house and said we weren't allowed to do this, and it's what our parents told us to do. After all, we're sharing. And she stopped me and said, you and your friends are criminals. In fact, she had a specific word for the kind of criminals we were. She said that we were pirates. Now, at 10 years old, I had a pretty clear image in my mind of what a pirate was. So as she's telling me that I'm a pirate, my mind flashes to this imaginary Scooby-Doo episode in my head, where the villain of the week are software pirates. I imagine my friends and I as being chased around by the mystery gang and finally catching us in the end. And Fred, the ascot-wearing alpha male of the mystery machine, says, look, they did it by hooking two 1541 drives together. And we turn around and we take our masks off and say, we would have gotten away with it too if it wasn't for you darn kids. This image of what we were doing didn't fit with the reality. We seemed to be doing what our parents wanted us to do. We seemed to be sharing and helping each other. That seemed right to me, but I couldn't really explain that to Evelyn at 10 years old, so I did what most self-respecting 10-year-olds would do and said that she was really mean and stormed out of the meeting and didn't come back. But it continued in my mind that there were people in the world who didn't think sharing made sense. And I really didn't understand why people felt this way and why the world was structured this way, but the experience stayed with me until about 9 years later, when I got my first programming job. And I began to experience that in the real world, as just like in the kids' world of video games, the feeling about sharing was pretty much the same, but the consequences were a lot bigger. My first programming job was for a blood typing laboratory. They did mostly paternity suits in those days of people would, one woman accused of the guy being the father, and they all get blood tests, and then we do calculations to figure out the probability that he was the father or wasn't the father. And we wrote this big software system, and underneath we used the Informix database products as the whole database that stored all the blood lab results and so forth. We're running this on an AT&T System 5 Release 2, 3.2, on an AT&T 3B2 600, you know, the old iron Unix machine. And I was excited that I got to use a real Unix system for the first time in my life, and I even enjoyed learning the VI text editor. That's how excited I was. And after a couple of weeks, I started getting assignments to work on various programs. And, of course, every program we wrote had to, underneath, talk to the Informix database system. It did it through a library by embedding SQL statements in the C code. So every program you wrote linked against the C library, or the ESQL C library provided by Informix. So after a couple of weeks, I started to discover various bugs in the software I was working with. I couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong in various cases, but my programs didn't seem to work correctly. And I spent 4 or 5 days, maybe a week, trying to figure out why it was that a particular program wasn't functioning. And I'd been doing programming long enough since I was a kid that I knew if you have a piece of code that doesn't work, get it down to the smallest number of lines that can produce the bug so that you can isolate it and try and figure out what's going on. So I did that and still couldn't find the problem. I went to one of my coworkers, somebody much older, probably 10 years, 15 years older than me, and said, "Greg, I'm trying to figure out why this software doesn't work. Could you look at my code and see what I've done wrong?" And he looked at my code and audited it line by line, this little short example I had that exhibited the bug, and said, "Everything looks fine. I don't think it's actually a bug in your program. I think it's a bug in the underlying Informix library." I said, "Well, that really can't be possible because we got the Informix stuff in a shrink wrap box with a manual. So how could it possibly have any bugs in it?" And he tells me, no, I've been working with Informix software for 10 years. There's tons of bugs. But fortunately, this particular client site has a tech support contract. So you can call up and report the bug and explain it to them. You can even email your code example to them, and they'll look into it and get back to you and tell you how to fix it or how to work around it if they don't have a fix for it. I said, "Okay, great." So I called up the tech support line, and this is programmer tech support, so it's not the tier one scripted tech support, but actual programmers on the other end you get to talk to, which was pretty good support, all things considered, at least we thought. So I explained the bug to this guy, and he took it down, and I emailed him the little code example, and he looked it over, and a couple days later he calls me back and says, "Yeah, this is a bug in the library on the AT&T 3B2 platform, and I don't know when it's going to get fixed. We don't have a workaround at this time. Could I just close out the bug report?" I said, "Well, I really need a fix. I've been dealing with this for a while, and I really want to find a way to fix it. I mean, maybe we can talk through it. We can figure it out. I know the 3B2 platform's a little quirky. It was hard to get things compiled and didn't have sockets. This is bizarre, and so forth." So I said, "Well, maybe we can help figure out what's going on." He says, "No, I'm pretty sure." And the other thing I asked him, I said, "Well, why is it 3B2 specific? Is it fixed on other platforms?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, this particular bug's been fixed on SANOS for a couple of years, but there's never been a 3B2 backport of that fix." I said, "Well, maybe we could do something about the 3B2. He says, "No, there's nothing that can be done. I just need to close out the bug report. Is that okay?" And this experience was pretty surreal. As I was saying, we had become kind of experts on this platform. It was quirky. It was pre-system 5 release 4, and we had gotten used to the way of getting various things working on the platform and how it differed from other Unix-like systems. So I probably didn't know enough about the platform to fix it, but Greg probably did, or somebody on the site probably did. But I didn't even bother to ask him for this code because I'd learned 9 or 10 years before what happens when you ask people to share software with you that don't want to share it with you. So I just meekly hung up the phone and gave up. And it was really, I think, a surreal experience because this was programmer tech support. They're supposed to help other programmers. But the first thing that probably happened the first day this guy went into work was he was ordered to sign something that made him promise not to do his job. He probably had to sign a non-disclosure agreement about the software he was viewing. He probably was required, as part of his job, to not help the programmers who called him in the most natural way two programmers help each other. I'm sure those of you that are computer science students have had the experience of trying to get a friend to help you debug a program. And eventually it comes down to showing the friend your source code so they can see what you're doing. Because even anything beyond the most trivial of questions requires actually looking and sharing the source code to work together to solve the problem. But in this particular case, the tech support for programmers was set up in a way that required that they not help any programmers whatsoever in the natural way that two programmers help each other. I think this is a bizarre thing to have be true, but it was standard and often still is standard. When you get tech support for programming from somebody who produces middleware, they're not allowed to share the software with you and help you in the most natural way that makes sense. So I just gave up on that particular problem, and I found that as my career continued, this happened over and over again. I was always in this situation where I was helpless to solve some particular problem because the upstream software that we had some bug or another in it. And it's not just that I and the programmers I worked with lost productivity. The users lost a great deal of productivity as well. The company I was working for did blood typing on lab results. They didn't care where the bugs were that we had to find. They wouldn't even have cared if we had made the change and donated the software back to Informix. All they wanted was for the software to work so they could get their job done. That had nothing to do with what the underlying database did or some bug in the software. They would have happily paid us to find Informix's bugs so that we could move on and get to the next thing that we needed to do for them. And the problem was, though, that we didn't have the freedom to do that. We didn't have the right to do that because the software was licensed under proprietary terms. And as I continued my software development career, it continued to be pretty much the same. So I decided at one point that I wouldn't do software development anymore, that there was another career I could have, another career track in computer science that I could do, and I heard how easy it was, and you didn't have to do any work, and you just sat around all day. It was called system administration. So I was pretty excited until I actually started doing the job and realized that it's a lot more work most of the time than software development and a lot more under-the-gun kind of stuff. But at the time, I was really excited because it sounded real easy in the land of dreams where you just sit there and hide from the users and never do any work. So my first sysadmin job that I got was for Westinghouse, which by and large, the divisions I worked for don't exist anymore. They were swallowed up by Northrop Grumman. And I was with the mobile satellite telephone division of Westinghouse. These are satellite telephones that talk directly up to the satellites and don't go through any of the typical cellular mobile infrastructure. They're used if forest rangers use them and other places where you don't have infrastructure. They're used in a lot of rescue environments where if you have a hurricane going on in Florida, the mobile towers might be down or not functioning, so you have a way to communicate with regular telephone numbers across a satellite link. And they were pretty expensive devices, and they developed the embedded software that went inside the telephones. And I was just supporting their use of the Solaris systems that were there that they used to actually do that software development. So the details of what I was doing really didn't matter to what the company was doing. They just needed these machines to work so that they could get their job done to write the software so that forest rangers could talk to each other and they could do rescue situations when there were hurricanes and that sort of thing. So I was in charge of these Solaris machines. And they had a whole list of bugs when I showed up. They'd been without a sysadmin for a while, and there was these annoying things about the system as it was set up that were causing them trouble. The number one thing on my list was that they were using this NIS Plus authentication system, a proprietary Solaris login authentication system. And they discovered this bug that when XDM, which is the X-Windows login program that presents you with your login password prompt on an X-Windows screen, that when they typed in their username and password the first time in the morning, it didn't work correctly, even if they typed everything without any mistakes. And they discovered, though, that those users who had logged in the night before through a modem connection via remote access we're able to log in just fine. So there's some sort of timeout bug with the length of time since you'd last logged in. So what they would do every morning is they would find somebody who had logged in the night before, which means they got in that morning and had an active login. They'd go over their machine, remotely log into the machine back on their desk, which made an active login. They'd log back out. They'd come back to their machine and log in, and everything would work fine because they'd recently had a remote login close enough that the timeout bug wasn't causing a problem. This took about 45 minutes every morning. Everyone would wander around to each other's desk trying to find somebody who got an active login that morning, use it to log back into their own machine, and everybody would be able to log in and work just fine. And there was a Westinghouse rule that you couldn't leave yourself logged in overnight, so they couldn't do that either. So they had this problem, and they wanted me to solve it and find a way that they didn't have to wander around. Management was particularly worried about this because it was wasting valuable time every morning as people wandered around and chatted looking for active logins. So I looked into the problem, and I found actually on Sun's website a list of bugs related to NIS Plus with their interaction with X Windows, and this was actually one of them, XDM login not functioning but remote okay or something like that. So I called them up and said, great, they know about this bug already. I don't have to like convince them it's a real bug. Call up Sun Tech Support and say, hey, look, we have this bug. We don't know what to do. How do I fix it? It's not working. And you've got patches for Solaris 2.5, but we're running 2.4. You know, can we get the backported patch for Solaris 2.4? And they said, well, no, you have to upgrade to Solaris 2.5. And I said, well, how much is that? It was like $800 a seat or something like that. I said, well, we can't do that. One, because I don't have the budget for it. Two, because we've actually done an ISO 9000 regression test on the whole environment, and it has listed in it all the versions of software we're using. And the only thing we can get away with doing is critical bug fixes. We can't do any major change to upgrade the operating system. We just have to stick with bug fixes. And after all, Solaris 2.4 is only about a year and a half old at this point, so it's still pretty actively used. I said, by the way, I noticed that you've fixed a number of other X Windows NIS Plus interaction bugs on the website for 2.4, and there's patches for those, which of course I've installed, but they don't fix this particular bug. Why is it you fixed some of them and not all of them? They said, oh, we did those because NASA requested them, and they're a big Sun customer, and they can tell us to do things, and we have to do them, but you're just not a big enough Sun customer to demand that kind of service. Now, of course, I was surprised to learn that Westinghouse was a small Sun customer because Westinghouse was pretty big in these days, but we were a small division of Westinghouse, so they treated us like a tiny customer. So I wasn't able to fix the problem. And I found myself going back to the users and delivering that same message that I had heard a couple years before from the Informix tech support guy. Yeah, this is a bug in NIS Plus. No, I don't know when it's going to get fixed. We're just going to have to hope somebody logged in the night before and so we can all get logins in the morning. So that kind of apathy that gets created by proprietary software is rampant. People don't feel like they can get their jobs done, and they're not empowered to get their jobs done because they don't have access to the software. I had actually run strace against the binary. I knew the exact place where it was making the call back to X Windows and exactly, more or less, exactly, I didn't have the source code, what needed to be fixed, at least where the bug would be and where I'd have to go in the code. But I didn't have access to the source code for the version of X Windows I was running. I didn't have access to the source code for NIS Plus. Sun didn't want to help me because I wasn't NASA. So I had nothing that I could do to fix the problem. Just had to hope that the users would be happy with the shoddy system that they had. Now, all of this isn't to say free software isn't without bugs. We have our share. A lot of people argue we have more than our share. It's not even to say that the original developer of the particular free software program you find a bug in will care about your bug. They may be just like Sun in my particular situation, or just like Informix, saying they don't care about this bug, it doesn't matter to them. The difference, though, with free software is that you have the means yourself to improve and fix the software, or to hire anyone you want to improve and fix the software for you. And this, I think, is the fundamental reason that I've moved to free software and become a professional advocate for free software. But at the time, I was kind of convinced that I could never do what I wanted to do in computer science. I came into this field because I wanted to make computers easier to use for people. I wanted people's lives to be better because of technology. But I was pretty sure at that point that I couldn't do that. And this was most evident when I remembered an experience right between my time at the RH lab and my time at Westinghouse. I worked for 3 months on a contract for Lucent Technologies to re-engineer a legacy system. It was used to configure telephone switches. And the telephone switches in those days were actually sort of sophisticated Unix boxes. And in fact, the 4ESSs, which was the standard telephone switch, is actually used today in a lot of places still. And the gurus who understand these boxes can actually log into the thing, I guess via SSH these days, and actually fix things with VI on the command line and do all kinds of weird stuff to the telephone switch. But the average person you call up when you ask for Lucent to implement a Centrex or some other system for your business, phone system for you, don't know how to do this. So Lucent had developed a product for use by the baby bells who use these switches to configure them through a nice little user interface and so forth. It wasn't a nice little user interface. It was a rather clunky user interface, but certainly better than what the gurus had to know to be able to get the job done. And in fact, as they were beginning this re-engineering process, they had this big user group meeting. They invited all the baby bells to come, back when there were baby bells, right? They all come. 9X is there. Southwestern Bell is there. Pacific Bell is there. All talking about how they want to use the program. I thought, this is great. We're actually listening to users. We're going to do what they want us to do and make the software better. I was actually pretty optimistic as I went into this user group meeting. And we listened to them describe all these various bugs that they had in the software they were using. And there was this one bug that was wasting like 5 or 7 minutes every call because they had to go in deep into one menu structure and then escape all the way out. And there was lag in the system, so if they hit escape one too many times, they were too far out. And they had to dig back down into a separate menu structure. And there was no easy way to connect up these menu systems or the way the software had been originally designed. And I was looking at our new design. I went back to my desk after that day's user group meeting and started looking at what we were doing. I went to my boss. I said, this is just great. I can solve that problem for free because it just comes out of the wash with our new redesign. And the menu structures won't have to be that way, and it'll be perfect. It'll solve this problem. He looks at me and says, okay, do you know how to turn it off? I said, well, what do you mean turn it off? I mean, nobody wanted the menu structures laid out in the way that they are. We don't want to turn this off. This should be the default. He goes, no, we have to be able to turn it off. We have to make the old interface the default and make this an add-on option. So, well, why is that? He says, because we can get more money out of them by requiring them to pay extra for that. It's interesting, because 2 days before, I had seen a budget sheet for the division I was working in. Division of 50 people was making a profit of $500,000 a month of licensing fees and support fees and upgrade fees from all these baby bells who were just paying every month for large amounts of money for the new upgrades. But they had a way in the contract that they could add a little extra thing, a bell and whistle, that they could charge separately for. So they were going to exploit this little hole in the contract, even though their profits were completely fine for the time, because they could get away with it. And what that experience showed me, more than all the others, was that in most of the software industry, turning a profit and getting the profits as high as possible is substantially more important in a lot of proprietary software companies than making the lives of people better through technology. Now, I don't have anything against profit. I like to get paid. I like to make money. I enjoy that I don't have to not work and that I can get money for what I do. But I also don't think that the biggest goal in working with computers is to make money. And if you happen to be one of the people who thinks that it is and feels that the only reason you're doing this computer stuff is to make a lot of money, then we probably don't have much we can connect on. And you probably ought to apply for a job at Microsoft and try to move up in their corporate structure because that's the way that they think there, and Oracle is much the same. But if you perhaps think that making money doesn't have to be number one, even if it's just as number two, and that the first thing is to make the technology better for people to be happier and for people's lives to be better, then I think we have something to talk about. Because what I discovered in the IT industry is that with a focus solely on profit, the whole mission of computer science is forgotten. It led me to be pretty much apathetic to the whole industry and how it worked. I pretty much wanted to give up on computer science altogether. But I was discovering, because I was going to college at the same time I was working, that there was actually another alternative, that there was another way of doing things. And this is because in 1992, I became an early adopter of what today is the GNU plus Linux system that you may have heard under the name just Linux. I didn't understand any issues about software freedom or why sharing was important other than what I vaguely understood from my experiences. I just needed a low-cost, i.e. free beer, Unix-like operating system that I could use on my own machine to get my computer science homework done. And I discovered that there was this software out there, and I installed it on my machine and started showing it to my professors and showing them how it worked and that it was available and it was under this license called the GPL and you could copy it as much as you want and it wasn't illegal and you were allowed to share it. And they said, that's really interesting because we've just got a price quote from Sun to buy a bunch of new machines for our lab, but we can't afford them, A, because Sun's hardware is too expensive and B, because the software licenses are too expensive. Meanwhile, commodity PC hardware, we can get three times the machines at the same price. And if you could install this stuff on the systems, we'd have Unix-like workstations for all the students, and we wouldn't have this problem where everybody's trying to share just a very few number of machines. We have enough for everybody so that nobody really has to wait for a machine. So they hired me that summer to actually install GNU Linux on this new batch of Dell computers that we were getting. So actually, as early as 1992, I went into the business of supporting free software. I was paid a stipend for that summer to make these systems work with free software. And I quickly discovered that it wasn't as easy as it all looked. There were bugs and problems. The biggest problem we had in those days was that the Control-Alt-Delete sequence on the keyboards was hardwired in the kernel named Linux, what the activity that would happen if you hit the Control, Alt, and Delete all at once. It actually automatically did a system reboot. These days, that's controlled by the init system, and you can tell it what operation on the system you want to happen when somebody hits those keys. But in those days, it was hardwired, or so it appeared. Now, the problem was that a lot of the students were coming from regular computer labs into this new lab that we were creating that had Unix-like systems. And in the regular labs, they apparently had to hit this key sequence a lot. Apparently, they were running some operating system that requires you to hit this over and over again for no apparent reason. So we didn't want them to come in and do this, particularly because we wanted to allow remote access to these machines and somebody could be logged in from their dorm room using the machine remotely. And if somebody hits this key sequence, they've rebooted the machine on them in an instant. So they said, well, you got to fix that. That's a problem. So, well, what am I going to do? And, of course, I was a sophomore in computer science. I know there's some sophomores in the room. But I had this belief that, well, any software problem I know how to fix because I'm a programmer. So I started grepping the source code for the kernel named Linux for the words Control, Alt, and Delete. And lo and behold, I found a function called Control, underscore, Alt, underscore, Del. And I saw that it did a bunch of things that I didn't really understand. And then it called the halt system call. So being a sophomore in computer science, I said, well, anytime something doesn't do what you want it to do, you just comment it out, recompile, and everything will be fine. Now, in the general case, this is a really bad thing to do. In this specific case, it was exactly what was needed. I commented out the halt system call, recompiled the kernel named Linux, installed it across the lab, and walked around pressing Control-Alt-Delete on every system. And absolutely nothing happened, which was precisely the behavior we wanted for this lab. So I found it amazingly rewarding and exhilarating to be able to fix this problem myself. I think it's ultimately liberating when you give people the tools to solve their own problems rather than requiring them to call up some tech support and beg for help and beg to get their problem paid attention to or fixed. And because of this experience and many others that I had with free software, by the mid-1990s, I understood what this ethical thing was about. I had seen real problems in the real world created by proprietary software, specifically because it was licensed under these proprietary terms. And I saw two things in the free software world. One, I saw that you could solve these problems yourself. And two, I saw that if you knew how to solve these problems yourself and could convince others that you were good at it, you could get paid to solve those kinds of problems. You could get paid to actually do rewarding and exhilarating work in the software industry rather than calling up tech support and begging them to fix your problem. Now, as time progressed, this free software stuff showed up on everybody else's radar screen sometime around the late 1990s, along with the dot-com boom. And in fact, it unfortunately got associated with that, which is really unfortunate because it's existed long before that and it's going to exist long after. And the mainstream media picked up on this and started focusing on a very specific aspect of what our community had done, that we'd made reliable, useful, dependable software that had by and large fewer bugs than the proprietary equivalents in very specific spaces such as web servers and operating system server software. And because they got focused on this aspect, the ideas of freedom and sharing throughout the late 1990s and into the early into this decade, people didn't realize that there was a political and philosophical basis that generated this community. And it goes back really far. Way back in 1984, when I was busy in my Commodore 64 club being called a pirate and getting told I shouldn't share software, Richard Stallman, who's my boss these days, was thinking about these same issues, was considering this because he had watched his own community of software sharing disappear. He is from the era, and many people of his generation remember the 1970s and what computing was like in the 1970s. In those days, you had big computer manufacturers who sold you giant pieces of iron, and the software was on there almost as an afterthought. It was there to make that big piece of iron useful to you. And they didn't really care if universities got access to it and improved it, it sold more hardware. They didn't care if you got access to improved it and sold it with another one of their clients. It might sell another hardware unit if you do that. It didn't really matter that people had the source code to the software and were sharing it. If anything, it helped the sale of the hardware. But as the mid-1980s wore on, the whole thing changed. The PC revolution happened, and a few people discovered that they could invent a new way of doing software. They could license software rather than include it as part of the package. Bill Gates is often credited for inventing software licensing, although I've never seen any direct evidence that that's true. But certainly he's one of the few who benefited most from it, at least financially. They discovered that you could divide the whole user base, conquer each person one by one by forbidding them under license from helping the next person, forbidding the next person from helping the next person. And you could get each of them to pay some amount of money for stuff that actually had zero marginal cost. It was a pretty innovative idea from a business point of view, but it was not all that innovative from a freedom point of view. It took what was a community of software sharing and academic research and endeavor to improve computers and improve how they did their jobs for people into effectively a way to stop people from helping each other. And in looking at this, Stallman decided to create the free software movement. And it could have been done in a straightforward way. A lot of movements don't have the means to change things themselves. So this is why you see a lot of protests. And I suppose the free software movement could have designed itself as a movement that stood outside of offices of proprietary software companies like Microsoft and Oracle and held signs and said, make your software free or we're going to write letters and we're going to chain ourselves to your door and all these sort of things. You know, I feel bad for movements who have no other choice but to do that. But the innovative thing that Stallman discovered in the free software movement, in creating the free software movement, was that there was a really productive way of political action that could be done. People were upset about this proprietary software, upset that software didn't come with source code or the right to share it or modify it or improve it. And they said, well, what do you need to create an alternative? You need access to a bunch of computers and people with good minds for programming to create software. And in fact, the community that was falling apart because of the proprietarization of software was there to do this job. So what they did was start the GNU project, a project to create an operating system that worked like Unix but was in fact not Unix, created from scratch to work just like the proprietary equivalent but be available free as in freedom with the right to copy, share, modify and redistribute software. And this is where it all started. This is where we began to create something different that wasn't focused as profit as its highest motive. Free software has made a lot of money for a lot of people. I know even after the dot-com boom, personally, three millionaires who made their million from free software. Now, it hasn't generated any billionaires. You've probably got to do proprietary software to be a billionaire. But maybe you can settle for being a millionaire instead and do free software rather than being a billionaire and doing proprietary software. Because they can generate that level of unbelievable financial wealth by treating users badly and putting them in effectively an unfair position. See, when I think back to my first experience with Evelyn asking for a copy of Little Computer People, I realized that she was actually put in an unfair position. It wasn't her fault. She had to make a decision between obeying a software license that she had in good faith agreed to and doing the right thing for a child who was asking for a favor that was easy to do. I don't like myself to be put in that situation. If something's easy to do for somebody to help them out, I do it. I think we all do because we want to be good people and help the world. But proprietary software puts us in this situation where we have to choose between doing the nice thing and obeying the license we agreed to. And free software frees you from that ethical dilemma. I believe that we should have laws in a society. I believe that copyright law probably had a very good goal behind it. Indeed, our Constitution said it was there to create promote progress in science and the useful arts. A laudable goal, no question. But when you implement laws, they should make people's lives better. They should increase goodwill and cooperation. That's why we should have laws in our society. And the copyright system, as it's typically applied to computer software, does exactly the opposite. It uses this system to stop people from being allowed to help each other, stop people from improving the software they use and understanding the software they use. You can make a lot of profit the other way, but you can make a reasonable profit this way too. And in fact, in the free software world, you make profit in the typical way that you do in most proprietary software companies. Only the largest, most powerful companies like Oracle and Microsoft actually can make a profit on licensing alone. Most software companies make the bulk of their revenue from the typical models that we also use in the free software world. They make their revenue from service contracts, from support contracts, from custom modification to the software commissioned by a company who needs an improved feature. These methods of developing software, where you're commissioned to improve a software program that already exists, or you're selling a service contract for software that's already available, these are the models that make most of the money at the smaller company level in the software industry. I worked myself for a proprietary software company that did, in fact, charge licensing fees. But if you looked at the budget sheets, the licensing fees were this tiny little piece that barely even covered the cost of one of us or two of us, and there was like five or six programmers working for the company. The rest of the revenue to pay everybody else and to make the profits the company sent back to its shareholders, or private owners in this case, was from the service contracts and support and the hiring to improve the software for new changes and new features that was done. So these models are exactly the same in the free software world. In fact, they're more available because your ability to start up from scratch is much easier because there's all this existing free software infrastructure and the reference material is right in front of you today. The source code to the entire operating system and all the applications available in free software is available to you right now out there on the internet. You can learn how not the toy examples work, but how the production stuff that actually gets real work done in the real world every day works. And you can study it, and you can learn it, and you can improve it. You can become an expert on it. And in the free software space, the experts make the most money. The people who know the most make the most money, get the most contracts, find the most clients. This is a purely capitalistic way of designing an industry. I'm amazed when capitalists come to us and call us un-American and that we create a cancer on the software industry that will destroy it. We're substantially more capitalistic. We're opposing the government-determined monopoly in Seattle. We're saying, look, the software industry ought to be set up such that everybody has access to a competitive, free market where the amount you know about software and your ability to make it work for people is what determines how much money you can make and how many jobs you can get. That's the way I think a competitive, capitalistic software industry ought to work. I'm not really deeply capitalistic, but I see how the capitalist philosophy fits perfectly well with free software. It is, in effect, a meritocracy of people who know how the software works being able to get the best contracts and jobs. Of course, as we started to distribute free software in the 1980s, there was a real question about how to get it done. As I've said, our goal was to create a system that would make sure the software remained free. We wanted everyone to get these freedoms, so we had to consider what the terms of distribution would be. We obviously weren't going to release it under a proprietary license, but we quickly discovered as a community that licensing would be necessary, and here's why. The easiest way to avoid the proprietary way of doing things is to release software into the public domain. When you release software in the public domain, you're asserting no copyright whatsoever over it. And in fact, public domain software gives you the right to copy, share, modify, redistribute, and use the software in any way you see fit. The downside to that is that anyone else who would like to make a proprietary adaptation or modification to the software can do so and license it back out into the world under proprietary licensing terms. Pretty much everybody who worked early in the GNU project is sure that if GNU had been licensed in this way from the start, it would likely have been a failure, because anything that was particularly useful would have immediately been picked up by a proprietary software company, made into proprietary software, and the free version would constantly play catch-up with the proprietary version, since there was no incentive for them to cooperate with the free developers. So what was discovered was a new way of using copyright law, to take the world back to the old way that software exists before proprietary licensing. This new idea was called copyleft, because it took what copyright law typically did and flipped it over, turned it on its head to something different. What it said was, rather than prohibit the things that copyright law governs, which most software licenses do, i.e. copying, modifying, and distributing the software, this copyleft license from the start grants you permission to copy, share, modify, and redistribute the software. The only restriction placed upon you is that you can't, if you engage in these activities, restrict those rights from anyone else. In essence, it grants you all the freedoms that I talked about at the beginning of this talk, but forbids you to forbid those freedoms of anyone else. This is the general idea of how to do software sharing, and it needed a specific implementation. So Stallman sat down with a couple of lawyers and wrote the GNU General Public License, or the GNU GPL. GPL is effectively the constitution of the free software movement. It explains how legally you get all these freedoms to copy, share, modify, and distribute, but that no one who subsequently exercises those freedoms is able to take away your rights or anyone else's rights in the community. It does an interesting thing. It avoids the tragedy of the commons that comes about when software is in the public domain. Companies are unwilling to service the commons because there's no incentive to do so. There's no requirement to do so. They'll take but not give back. Bill Gates, when he spoke here a couple of months ago, talked very highly of this kind of software because it allowed companies to innovate around the software. What he was really talking about is it allows companies to take without giving back. It allows companies to chop down all the trees in your nature conservancy but not plant any new ones. What GPL does is it says, great, we want companies to be involved if you want to be. If you don't want to be and write your software from scratch, if Bill Gates wants to never touch GPL's code, he's permitted to. Unlike what he and his other executives say, it's not a cancer or a virus. You can't catch it just by sneezing in the direction of proprietary software. It has to actually be brought into your software. And once you choose to do that activity, you have some obligations to the community that gave you that benefit. It's a club that nobody's required to join, but once you join, you have rules that you have to follow. You have to make sure that you give other people the same rights that you got when you got the software. But we don't have anything against free software under non-copylefted licenses. It has this drawback. In fact, I'd experienced it myself when I was working at Westinghouse with the Solaris machines. X-Windows, in fact, was free software under a modified BSD license, which is effectively the same as public domain in its details. So I got a copy of XDM that was free software when Sun got it, but they made proprietary modifications to integrate it with NIS Plus, and by the time I got it, it was proprietary software. So I had actually been a victim myself of this problem that comes up when software is not copylefted. But at the same time, as we were trying to build a free software operating system from scratch, we had to look for shortcuts. There was no reason to reject existing free software that granted freedoms if it was there, even if it wasn't copylefted. So the GNU project started adopting other various free software programs that were around. The X Windows system is a great example. It's the default windowing system for GNU plus Linux systems. The TEC document formatting system was adopted as the official formatting engine for the GNU system. And by 1991, pretty much all the different components had been assembled except for one, the kernel. Meanwhile, someone was interested in operating system development over in Finland and decided to write a kernel from scratch called Linux. That kernel integrated with the existing GNU software and created what is the modern GNU plus Linux system that most people shorten to just Linux. And the reason that we continue to talk about this history of the GNU system in relation to Linux is that GNU was started because of a philosophy for freedom. Linux was started because Linus was interested in the technology and wanted to start doing a project. He picked our license, the GPL, for his project because he liked the stuff that we had already done. But it isn't a project that's focused on this political issue of software freedom, the rights you ought to get with software. But this whole community came into being specifically because people who were very focused on rights for users and programmers were working to create this operating system that would be freely available and freely shared. So we continue in our community to focus on these ethical issues and talk about the importance of community and cooperation and sharing of software to help other people. A lot of times you hear it talked about in terms of open source. That term has primarily become the corporate way of thinking about it. And we think it's good that corporations want to get involved with what we do, and we understand that companies aren't particularly interested in talking about political issues. So that's a good term to think about in those terms when you're thinking about the corporate side of this, why it's usable software and why a company would want to use it. I continue to say free software rather than open source to get across the idea that this is about freedom, that we did all this work to give people certain rights and to effectively make those rights inalienable. Because I believe very strongly that computer scientists need to consider the ethical and sociological impact of the work they do. Too often, we get focused as computer scientists on technology. We focus on the exciting, great, whiz-bang new technology that we've developed and new software we've written that does all kinds of amazing things and forget that, A, there's a bunch of users out there who need to be given the benefit of this technology and the technology should be shared with them. And B, we have to think about how that creates a community and how software can be used to foster community and foster people helping each other. Too often we get focused just on the technological issues. So I encourage you to think about this issue when you're developing software. A lot of people say they don't have a choice. They have to write proprietary software, particularly the way the economy is now. People are happy to get any job they can get. And I'm not going to say that you've done a terrible thing if you take a proprietary software job. But think about this issue. Try, if you do take a proprietary software job, those of you who are students when you graduate, talk to your employers about free software. Try to get them to do a little bit of it if you can. If you're able to volunteer some time for various free software projects when you're not working to try and help create a free software infrastructure. I guarantee you if you learn a piece of free software really well, you'll find it helps you greatly in your career. It will change the way you're able to understand software and collaborate on projects. And that's a skill that any employer needs, no matter what kind of software development they do. And I encourage you to think about these issues and see if you can find a way to make money doing free software. There are a lot of business models out there, support and service and modification and so forth, that are really usable and they work. Now, the other side's going to argue that we're here to stop innovation. You're going to hear a lot of that. I'm sure you heard it when Bill Gates was here. I heard some pieces of excerpts of the speech where he was saying that we're out here to stop innovation and stop things. And I actually think that the truth is we make a competitive free market like I was talking about. Free software ends up causing the software industry to function a lot like other professional endeavors that we're used to. One great example is the law. Lawyers still make a lot of money, and pretty much any economy, good lawyers make a lot of money. But the law in the United States is free in the senses that I've been talking about. all the laws are available to study. You can go to a library and read all the laws of our society and learn them. If you don't want to learn them on your own, you can go to a law school and pay them to teach you about the law. But most of the time, we don't do that as individual citizens. We hire an expert to help us understand things that we don't understand rather than trying to learn it all ourselves. This is why people hire lawyers. And people who are better lawyers and understand the law better are able to get more money for their services. Now, we could design a society that has proprietary law in the same way we have proprietary software. In my science fiction fandom, I've seen this kind of culture. In the Star Trek universe, there's the Cardassians, who have a legal system whereby you're told your sentence before you go to trial, and the trial is just a big show thing, and they tell you, okay, you're going to be executed, and you don't get to see the evidence and examine it, and you don't get to know which law you violated that's causing you to be executed. We could design that kind of legal system. They have existed in our history, but nobody would call that legal system free. It certainly functions more efficiently. It certainly works to make the society move along nice and smooth. But it's not free in the senses of freedom that we think about. And the same thing's true in the software world. Sometimes free software requires a little more work to get going. Sometimes to get a project done, it takes more effort. But the end outcome is free in that sense. It's available to the public in that sense. And the experts still are an important part of the economic ecosystem of software, just as they are in proprietary world, even more so in the free software world. I want to end by saying, and take as many questions as you'll like to ask, by pointing out that it's up to the next generation of computer scientists to decide where this goes. I was told today in one of our classes that I did one of these ethics classes here on campus that we're failing because we haven't succeeded in beating Microsoft. I'm not looking at what happens in the next few years. I'm looking farther out, the next 10, the next 20, the next 50. What is computer technology going to be like? Is it going to be available to everyone freely so that they can learn and grow and actually have access to the technology that they're using? Or is it going to be closed and proprietary and forbid people from sharing and forbid people from learning? Are the computer science education programs of the next generation going to be reading manuals of proprietary software and being told, well, when you get to work for Oracle or Microsoft someday, you actually get to learn how this stuff works in the real world, but we can't tell you because it's proprietary. It's a strange way to run an education system, but we're headed in that direction. If you're using Microsoft computers to do your computer science homework, think about the fact that you're learning computer science on a system you can't, that is an implementation of the ideas you're learning, yet you can't study that implementation. It's a strange system to be under. I hope that you'll choose to use the GPL for the software you write to help society and help people learn and help the community get more access to software. And I hope that if you end up working in the proprietary software world, you'll at least become a member of the Free Software Foundation and send some of that big fat check to us so that we can continue the work, even if you're not able to contribute for whatever reason. I hope you'll fight for a free and cooperative culture that profits not just you individually or companies, but the whole of society. I thank you for your time. I'm happy to talk in detail about anything that you guys want to ask about. Does anybody have any questions?
I have one.
Sure.
When the questions come up, could you repeat the questions?
I'm happy to do that. Now we just need a question. Yeah, go ahead.
So you suggested that public domain software won't succeed because of companies hanging up and So what do you think of the factors that led to the success of various PSD operators?
Well, I think the question is regarding the public domain. So the point I made about public domain software and being being snatched up by proprietary companies and likely the proprietary versions becoming the default. The BSD systems actually have a really interesting history that's a lot more complicated than just initially being released in the public domain. The BSD system remained in a legally nebulous situation for about 6 years or 7 years as the various universities that had worked on BSD fought in court with AT&T for the rights to distribute it. And by the time all that was done, what was left was a bunch of remnants of a system that were then, because the people who had fought the legal battle were so gung-ho about finally getting the source code and finally getting the right to distribute it, there was a lot of momentum already there. It's different in a project that's just starting up. It's much more difficult to get, I think, a project started and going. If it's any good, it's probably going to be picked up. I point out, for example, the TCL language, Tickle. It was released into the public domain, and it actually suffered really badly because of it, because there was really no interest to maintain the common language infrastructure, because everybody wrote all these proprietary tools based on it, and the language is really ghettoized these days. I mean, it's not the best language in my technical opinion, but I think the licensing had a lot to do with the willingness people had to continue working on the language infrastructure itself. And there's a lot of different examples like that. It's not that the public domain software disappears completely, is never touched again. It's more of that there's really little incentive for the people with the most dollars to contribute back to the commons, because they can just take it up and proprietorize it. You compare it with something like GCC, where we've gotten large pieces of GCC contributed because companies said, what's the best compiler out there? And we want to use it, but I guess we have to release it if we do. And we say, well, yes, you do if you distribute it. And they're more willing to cooperate. The BSD community has a tendency to use a different form of pressure. We use a legal system, a system that has legal teeth to defend the freedoms, which I think is a little bit better. The BSD folks tend to use market pressure. In fact, in the BSD community, it's common when somebody makes a proprietary fork of BSD, they'll specifically design the next release to be incompatible, such that they force the proprietary company to keep playing catch-up and have two parallel code bases and making it difficult for them to share code back and forth. I mean, that's the mechanism typically used in the BSD community to discourage proprietary forks. While that works sometimes, I think it's actually better to have the legal infrastructure defending your freedom rather than just relying on little tricks you can do to force people to come back into the free world. And that's actually worked for the BSD community at times, but it requires a lot of technical effort and sometimes the wrong technical decision so that you can force this other company to stop proprietorizing the code. So I think that while it's not an automatic thing, it's somewhat of a gray area, it tends to be the case that less corporate development will happen around a free infrastructure if it's not under a copyright license.
Could you explain what trusted computing is and what your reaction to it is?
Well, the question is about so-called trusted computing. Trusted computing, as it's been defined, is an initiative not for you to trust your computer more, which is what it sounds like from just the words, but making sure that the MPAA and the RAA and Microsoft can trust your computer. Generally, it's believed that in our culture that technology and electronic devices should be there as your servants. They're not sentient beings after all, so there's no reason that we shouldn't put them into servitude. They're devices, pieces of utility. What trusted computing will do if it succeeds is turn it so that your computer is not your slave anymore, as it should be. It's a device, should be serve you. Instead, it will be the servant of the media companies and the proprietary software companies. And here's how. What trusted computing is trying to do, although they publicly say it's, you know, to make your software more solid and more secure and so forth, but the real thing that it will do is require that every software program that runs on your computer and every activity that happens on your computer has a digital signature attached with it that authenticates your ability to do that. So, for example, if you want to go in the future to the New York Times website and read an article in the New York Times, it will be able to query under a trusted computing infrastructure your computer and say, well, are they running the version of Windows that won't let them cut and paste my article into their email client and email it out to a friend? And your computer will answer yes or no for you, and you won't be able to change what your computer says, because there'll be a hardwired chip that you can't break into inside the computer that has a sealed key that will tell what the real answer is. And if you say yes, the New York Times lets you view the thing and you can't cut and paste. If you say no, it will not let you view the website. Now, it's not really the New York Times that wants this so desperately. It's Jack Valenti, who I hear is going to be here soon. You should ask him this question if that's what he really wants. And he probably won't tell you that it is, but we're pretty sure that that's what he wants. What the media companies want is a leak-proof pipe all the way from their media content distribution system to your eyeball and eardrum. Because if there's any kind of leak whatsoever in that pipe, because the delivery mechanisms are now digital, making a perfect bit-by-bit copy of anything that comes your way is trivial to do. Now, it's not that we encourage people to infringe copyright. In fact, we think it's a bad idea to infringe copyright for a variety of different reasons, maybe not the same reasons that Jack Valenti thinks, but generally we think that it's not a good idea to do that. You should pick a thing that you're allowed to share. It's why we encourage you to use free software that you're allowed to share rather than be put in that ethical dilemma with proprietary software. But if this thing happens, you won't be allowed to make that choice anymore. Your computer will have a robot guard on it, asking the question every time you cut and paste something, every time you watch a movie or listen to a song, and say, do you have a license to do this activity? ACM guys, your tune server in the other room over there in your ACM office will not work anymore in a trusted computing environment, because I'm pretty sure all the songs I was clicking on this afternoon were not licensed for you to publicly perform them for me. Now, I think it's a very ambiguous situation, what's going to happen regarding to file sharing. And I don't really have a position on it, at least on behalf of the foundation, because we're focused on the issues of freedom for software, not music and movies and other things. What I do believe, though, is that we shouldn't have a culture where there are robot guards on every computer checking whether every activity you engage in is licensed for you to engage in. It's strange because in Soviet Russia, they actually had physical guards at every photocopier to make sure what you were photocopying was something you were allowed to photocopy for a variety of reasons, including copyright infringement. Now, in our culture, getting physical guards at every computer is impossible, but trusted computing would give you the robot guard at every computer checking whether or not you're allowed to do various things. And just by an additional side effect, free software is ghettoized. Because even if you have a version of free software that doesn't allow you to cut and paste, doesn't allow you to make copies of movies, even in ways that you're legally supposed to be allowed to, by the way, you're always allowed under the Betamax ruling to make personal backup copies of your own movies and music and so forth, and space shift and time shift, all these legal concepts we have that allow you to do certain fair use copying, even if you engage in those activities, you'd be prohibited. And even if your operating system is free software, but it's set up to prohibit those, you'll never be able to engage in the activities free software allows you to do in a practical sense. And here's why. Imagine a free software system that's authenticated to not allow you to cut and paste the New York Times and not allow you to save Jack Valenti's movies to your disk drive. You could adapt a free software system to do that. You may be able to even convince companies to authenticate you so that you'd be able to watch those movies on your system. However, suppose you need to patch a bug in your kernel, and you do that. You reinstall the new kernel. All of a sudden, your digital signature doesn't match the authenticated rubber stamp version of the kernel that didn't allow you to cut and paste. So your ability to engage in those freedoms that free software assures you are basically gone in trusted computing if you're using free software on the trusted computer. Because once you reboot with that new version of the kernel, you won't be able to read the New York Times, you won't be able to watch any movies, you won't be able to do lots of things you were used to doing on your computer, just because you patched a security bug in your kernel. So trusted computing is probably the biggest threat that free software faces. We're fortunate at this point because it doesn't look like it's going to succeed. The companies that are pushing it are not as interested in it as they once were, primarily because the MPAA and the RIA are pushing on them to do it, and they're second-guessing whether or not they just want to do what the MPAA and the RIA want them to do. Intel does have its own mind and realizes that, gee, maybe we shouldn't do what Jack Valenti tells us. So we're fortunate. In fact, it's believed in our community now, people who do research on this stuff, primarily at the EFF is where this research is going on, that every 6 months that goes by, the trusted computing's not rolled out. We're even further along never having it rolled out because we're getting to the point where these things are becoming so common, file sharing and so forth, that you won't be able to stop them by robot guard. We need to reevaluate as a society how we do copyright law in the digital age, and that's something I'm happy to address if people are interested. But in the meantime, trusted computing is a big threat to free software because it's going to demand that every computer be a robot guard for licenses. Yeah.
I'd like to talk about trusted computing in kind of a different way. I'm starting to come around to the idea that maybe the governments of free society should only be using free software. And I started thinking about that because of electronic voting machines. and how untrustworthy it is to have proprietary software running on them that no one can expect. And I'm wondering if there are any national governments out there that have made a policy switch to free software.
That's really two questions. One of them is about government policies to use only free software. And the other question is about voting and electronic voting and whether or not electronic voting ought to be proprietary. I'll go to the first one first. It's very interesting. Inside the United States, there's a lot of pushback about free software, and that's primarily because Microsoft and Oracle are U.S. companies, and SCO, for example, somebody's going to ask about SCO eventually, are companies that are working really hard in the U.S. media to make free software sound bad, to fight it, to stop it, because they see it as their biggest competitor, and they're probably right. It probably is their biggest competitor, although I don't agree very much with the rhetoric tactics that they're using to fight us, because they can't fight us on the merits, so they're coming at us with an American cancerous virus that eats up software like a Pac-Man. But outside the United States, there's a very different reaction. Realize that the governments of Western Europe are somewhat sick of siphoning their IT budgets back to U.S. companies. They'd rather be spending money on their own IT infrastructure. So, for example, in France, free software is becoming very popular because they're sick of paying licensing fees to Microsoft, a U.S. company, for all their infrastructure that they're trying to use and get their work done. They'd rather have French companies or other EU companies doing the work. So there's that pushback in Western Europe and in the industrialized world. In the emerging economies, like Brazil and India, what they're discovering is Microsoft's been playing a shell game with them. So 15, 20 years ago, Microsoft walked around South America through Brazil, through Uruguay, through Paraguay, more or less giving out no-charge copies of Microsoft Windows and so forth, charging licensing fees that were next to nothing. And what they've been doing is tracking the emerging economies. And as the GNP goes up, they raise their licensing fees. GNPs go up, they raise their licensing fees. So what these emerging economies are discovering is that they can't get out under the yoke of licensing fees because they just rise with their GNP. So they can't build their own internal IT infrastructure because every time they turn around, there's another BSA auditor knocking on their door saying, nope, your Windows licensing this month are this much more. You can't have Windows 98, which is what a lot of them are using, at $5 a copy anymore. It's $10 a copy, U.S., which is really silly for basically obsolete software. But they're continuing to push the licensing fees. And, in fact, they're their own worst enemy in this sense. Because what Brazil did, for example, was vote that all software-running governments must be free software in Brazil. They've actually developed an entire Portuguese Lotus Notes replacement. I've understood that basically nobody can use it because it's written completely, and the variable names are actually in Portuguese, and the documentation's in Portuguese, so nobody's actually went to the effort to translate it. But I've seen a demo of it, and it looks just like that Lotus Notes screen, you know, all the screens and so forth, everything looks the same. Of course, it's all in Portuguese. But they're developing their own IT infrastructure based around free software, because they're sick of sending, you know, every year more and more money outside the U.S., outside their country into the U.S. to basically increase Bill Gates' bankroll. So a lot of countries are making decisions like that and moving towards a free software infrastructure for their government. And it's actually happening in the United States, too. I recently worked with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for a decision that all software developed by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts itself will be released under GPL. So it's happening at the state level in the United States as well, not so much on the federal level, because Microsoft's really big into lobbying at the federal level to stop it. But outside the U.S., there's a much more receptive feel towards free software. Now, the second question regarding electronic voting, I want to be clear that the FSF doesn't take a position on whether or not there should be electronic voting or not. Our founder, Dr. Stallman, has his own opinions about this on his webpage, but the foundation as itself doesn't take a position one way or another. The position we do take is that any software that's a public service ought to be free software available to the public that it's serving. We firmly believe that if you're using a voting system, the source code for that voting system ought to be available to you. No question. In fact, we believe that any government service that's being provided to you for software ought to have its source code available to you, the public. So we strongly feel that that's the case for a whole host of different reasons, not only the voter verification issues and making sure the software does the right thing. There's a question somewhere in here, I think. I saw a hand go up before. I think you had your hand up before. I'm going to get you first, and I'll get you.
I was wondering, talking about trusted computing and comparing our, and you discussed the NBA and RIAA. Well, my understanding is that trusted computing is fairly neutral. There's a white paper by the guy at IBM that came up with this thing that's basically a chip that has a key on it, and you can disable it in a BIOS. As far as what you were describing with not being able to run, play movies with a free software system, isn't that already on play movies with a free software system? Isn't that already occurring now? I no longer use Windows, and unless I download an illegal piece of software in Player, has some illegal codecs. I can't watch Apple's movie files. I can't watch Windows files legally. Isn't that time already here? I'm not sure what.
It is to some extent. The difference would be in a trusted. I'll address it specifically. You're asking about the fact that, well, there's file formats that are proprietary that you can't watch with free software. So a lot of things that you would otherwise be allowed to do with free software is not permitted because the file formats aren't compatible with existing free software. And that's basically the same as trusted computing. You're arguing because it's already here because you're not allowed to do these various things. I want to address both points. One is the file format issue, and one is how that file format issue relates to trusted computing. I'll start by talking generally about the file formats. Certainly, it's always been a threat to free software when there's proprietary file formats that can't be read with free software. And one of the things, requirements I put on recording the speech is that if you put available on the net, that it'd be available in a format that can be played with free software. And that's really a decision that citizens can make and say, I don't want to use this format because it's not free software. And we're still in a place where we can do that. There's still enough market pressure that we can say we won't accept the iTunes format, we want MP3, or, as it was recently done, we have a way of decoding iTunes format and making it playable with free software. That's what we've done so far. The legal mechanisms they're using to stop that, because, frankly, engineers in the free software world are very good at figuring out file formats. I know some of them more, what we would call in the free software world, obscure file formats. I know you might not think of them that way, but the Apple's QuickTime format and other things that are vaguely obscure, true, we haven't tried to reverse engineer those as much as we have other things. But the things that are much bigger and much wider used, most all have been reverse engineered. The best example is the format the DVDs are encoded in. This was reverse engineered by a free software programmer who posted his results on the internet and made a program available, which was eventually incorporated into a product called LibDVD CSS, which allowed you to understand DVDs and play them on a free software system with GPL software. Now, using a law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA, the MPAA is allowed to argue that sharing that information is a criminal offense. The DMCA in Title I has a provision that says if you let people know how to circumvent a copy protection mechanism placed by the copyright holder on a piece of media, in this case, the encoding mechanism they used to put on the DVDs so that you had special players to play them, you are committing a felony in the United States. So they, in fact, have prosecuted people for felony offense of doing this in the United States. They've also filed civil suit that these things were trade secrets. Now, the interesting thing about trade secret law is that once somebody figures out your trade secret and releases it, as long as they weren't under contract with you, they haven't committed any offense. Once the trade secret's known, it's out. NPAA argued that this is a trade secret and humans just shouldn't know this thing, that it was wrong to share this information and was a violation of all kinds of different things, and it actually succeeded some in court. Now, I can tell you right now, if you want to play DVDs on your GNU Linux computer, go to the videoland.org site, which is hosted in France, download a library called libdvdcss, and you'll be able to do it. If you want to come up afterwards, I'll show you on my laptop how you do it, which, by the way, would be getting a felony, which I'm happy to do if you need the help. I like working for an organization that I'm allowed to do that. So that kind of legal mechanism is the real fear. And in this particular issue about file formats and so forth, the fact that there's this chilling effect of being able to tell people how certain formats work. And I have to understand that a similar thing happened regarding the iTunes issue recently. Now, the trusted computing side is a little bit different. The IBM guy who told you, well, in the white paper, well, it's on the BIOS, you can turn it on, turn it off, whatever you'd like, is correct. The problem is more of a sociological one. When most people have computers with trusted computing enabled, and most people are running operating systems that adhere to trusted computing standards, mainly the trusted computing standard called attestation, which is the ability to represent to the network that you are running a particular version of a particular set of software. That particular feature, if it becomes widely used, is the threat. That if the New York Times and every other website out in the world start saying, well, if you can't attest to being one of these 20 operating systems that we support, we refuse to allow you access to our site. When that becomes the standard, it ghettoizes free software. So it's not in the sense that free software becomes actually illegal. It's a sense that if you're a free software user, you're not able to do anything that we all currently do with free software systems. Read the New York Times every day and the simplest things that you currently can do. So it's not that we haven't finished reverse engineering the file format yet, which is really the case with the QuickTime scenario. It's even if we were able to reverse engineer the file format, we can't attest to being this particular operating system. Now, there are some nice features about trusted computing out there. I like some of them. For example, I'd like to be able to leave my laptop sitting there, walk out of the room, and be able to come back and know for sure that nobody has mucked with it and installed software that's going to catch my keystrokes and so forth. Trusted computing can do that nice thing as well. The real problem with trusted computing comes into play with this attestation issue. The EFF has a wonderful proposal out that basically says, fine, do trusted computing, but allow people to lie. Lying is a fundamental social mechanism we have in our society. We don't always tell the truth. When somebody says, do I look all right? You tell them they look fine, even if they've got a piece of basil in their teeth or something, right? And we have this mechanism. So you should be allowed to do this on your computer. If you want to attest to being Windows 95 version X out to the world, you should be allowed to attest to that. This is, as a poker player, this is really important to me. You should be allowed to represent a hand that you don't have. It's fundamentally right, at least in the United States. You should be allowed to do that. And I feel that's what we ought to do. If we have trusted computing, great. I'd love to be able to have that feature I want. But attestation is the real problem. There are lots of things about trusted computing, but that required attestation, that you can attest to being software that you're not, you can never lie on the network. That, I think, is fundamentally bad for our society. Yeah, go ahead. Let me get a follow-up, and I'll come over to you.
As far as the file format, what if there was a patent on the method of decoding CSS files? Would that mean that?
The question is would a patent on one of those file formats affect the free software infrastructure? Absolutely, yes. Patents are a huge issue that I'm happy to go into. Why don't I take a couple more questions and come back to it? The key point I want to make is that software is in a rare scenario. It is one of the only intellectual endeavors in society, in the United States at least, that is simultaneously covered by copyright law and patent law. And we believe that patenting on software ought to be abolished. Very grateful that the European Union recently voted not to allow software patents. We wish the United States would be that progressive because patents are a huge threat. Let me take one more question, and if there's time, I'll talk even more about it.
Okay. Mr. Gates was asked this question when he was here and didn't really give us a clear answer. So I'll ask you a similar question. Are you aware of any unfair competition between proprietary software and free and open source software?
Am I aware of unfair competition between proprietary software and free software?
Or do you even just have the sense that there is some?
I don't know what form such unfair competition would take. I don't know of any, certainly, but I don't know what it would mean to have unfair competition. We are, as far as the legal systems we're using pretty mundane copyright law to release our work. Free software work is copyrighted. It comes to you under a copyright license. You don't have to enter a contract with the developer. By the way, to get Microsoft's software, it's not only covered by copyright law, you also have to enter a contract with them. But we use a mundane copyright license. You can take and accept the license, and if you choose to copy, modify, and distribute, you either have to accept the license or stop using the software. Stop copying, modifying, distributing the software, I should say. So we think that that's a completely reasonable use of copyright law. Every copyright lawyer in the world I've ever talked to who doesn't work for Microsoft agrees with me. or I'm sorry, who doesn't work for Microsoft or SCO agrees with us. So I actually think that we're certainly doing nothing unfair whatsoever because we're just using copyright in this pretty straightforward, mundane way. Copyright law governs copying, modifying, and distributing of creative works fixed in a tangible medium. Software is a creative work fixed in a tangible medium, and we give you the rules for copying, modifying, and distributing it. Pretty fair to me. You can accept those rules and modify, copy, and distribute our software, or reject those rules and not do it. That's up to you. I think what Microsoft has been doing in their PR campaign is unfortunate and inappropriate, but in some sense a little bit funny. I find it amazing that Craig Mundy goes to Brazil about 6 or 8 months ago and says, the Free Software Foundation, this organization I work for, is the biggest threat to the global software industry in the world today. Now, our budget at the Free Software Foundation, I know because I'm the executive director and I'm responsible for the budget, is in 1 year the budget of Microsoft for 30 minutes. How in the world we're the biggest threat to the global software industry when our budget for a whole year is what Microsoft spends in 30 minutes doesn't make sense to me whatsoever. But it's somewhat rewarding in a sense because it means that we're on the radar screen, that they realize that freedom is the biggest threat. The choice in the world is, do you want the monopolist or do you want freedom? That's the argument that we're having right now, that we believe we're having right now. So I don't think that's unfair. I think the culture as a whole ought to be having this discussion. Do we want a world where all the software is locked up and proprietary, or do we want a world where it's free as in freedom available to people to copy, share, modify, and redistribute? I think it's a good argument to be having. I don't think it's unfair in any way. I think it's rather interesting, by the way, as far as you want to talk about competitive business practices. Microsoft right now throughout Europe has a word out to their sales engineers that they are not to lose a sale to quote Linux, unquote. And if they can stop losing the sale by not charging the customer, they should do so. Now, how not charging the customer is still a sale is very strange to me because you didn't sell them anything. But they're at the point where they're willing to give their software free as in beer for the sake of not having people switch to free as in freedom. A very strange situation. Any more questions?
Perhaps it's not losing a sale because they know later on down the line they're going to get some money out of you for something else.
Yeah, it's just like the way... we sort of see that as giving proprietary software away at no charge is kind of like the cigarette companies giving away cigarettes, you know, in developing nations, as they often do. They say, here, have some cigarettes at no charge, because they know you're going to get addicted and come back and buy some more. I think it's proprietary software being given away free as in beer is very similar. Eventually, they're going to come along and do the licensing. This is exactly what happened in South America. Initially, it's almost no cost, and then as the economy develops, they jack the price up. Very unfortunate. But it's in some sense, it's fortunate for us, in an ironic sense, because people really see the impact that proprietary licensing has on their culture. The reason I'm completely against the copying and sharing of proprietary software without license is not because I think it's unethical, but because I think it hides the real harm that proprietary software licenses cause. Because if you get your proprietary software without actually paying the licensing fee, you don't see the real impact that it has on you and everybody like you. So I actually tell people, you should pay for your proprietary software licenses. Figure out how much of your computer, when you buy a new computer, is that proprietary licensing fee. And really think about the direct harm that it's causing you to contract to rent something from a proprietary company that you have no right to learn from, no right to improve, no right to share.
I feel obligated to ask you to give us the rundown on SCO for the uninitiated who might be listening to this.
So about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, a company called the Santa Cruz Operation, which they actually don't use that name anymore. They're doing business as SCO, and they don't like you to call them the Santa Cruz Operation Limited anymore for some reason. Decided that as they were the inheritors, in their opinion, of the, quote, intellectual property, unquote, a term which we don't like much because we don't think of ideas as property, of the original Unix system, and they claimed that the, quote, operating system called Linux, unquote, of course, Linux is a kernel, not an operating system, as we pointed out to them, contains their, quote, intellectual property, unquote. And they sued IBM for an amount for a sum no less than $1 billion, saying that they had violated a variety of different quote intellectual property unquote agreements, and therefore owed them this money. It took them a while to actually say what they meant by, quote, intellectual property agreements, unquote. It turns out the primary dispute between SCO and IBM is a contract that SCO, or actually Novell at the time, we think, maybe, or some previous holder of the Unix stuff, had entered a contract with IBM to allow them to incorporate this technology under trade secret into AIX, IBM's Unix-like operating system, and that they were never allowed to incorporate this trade secret technology into anything else or release it to the public in source code form, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is the primary center of the dispute between SCO and IBM. A lot has been said in the community that it's about some patents that SCO holds. We've looked in the patent database. There are no patents that we can find that are implemented in the kernel named Linux or the operating system called GNU Plus Linux that SCO happens to hold. They hold a couple of patents that have nothing to do with that technology, I think, if they hold any patents at all. They don't have any copyright claims that we can tell. They had this big presentation where they showed the smoking gun of the source code in Linux that is copied from SCO. It turned out it was a piece of code from Dennis Ritchie's book on Unix that was written in the 1970s of the various different techniques that has been in the public domain for a number of years. And it was rewritten by the Linux developers in a matter of hours once it was pointed out that this might be under SCO's copyright. We don't think SCO has any copyrights in any software that's available as free software. At least we haven't been able to find any, and they won't tell us. We know that there is this trade secret dispute, and perhaps it is true that IBM, when they were working with our community to improve the kernel named Linux, included some technology that they had under trade secret with SCO. If that turns out to be true, which it might, we don't know, then IBM is in trouble. We'll see what happens in that court case. But nobody else is in trouble because IBM is the only entity that agreed under trade secret law to not engage in sharing that technology. And once the trade secret is out, as I was saying before, everybody who knows it is not liable. Only the person who entered into the contract to not release it is liable. So everybody running GNU plus Linux systems who aren't IBM are completely clear with regard to the trade secret claims. And then there's only other two places claims could be, patent claims or copyright claims. SCO doesn't seem to have any patents on the Unix technology, and they can't seem to produce what copyrights they hold. Now, in the meantime, SCO had a subdivision called Caldera that actually tried to go into the free software business model and release GNU plus Linux systems. They really didn't understand our community all that well, so they couldn't compete with companies like Red Hat, and they eventually went out of business. However, while they were in that business, and even up until today for existing customers of that business, they were distributors of the GNU plus Linux system and the kernel named Linux specifically. They distributed all the canonical versions of the kernel named Linux that everybody uses. Now, if they were distributing this stuff, and if it was under their copyrights, they distributed under terms of GPL. They didn't have any right to incorporate their copyrighted work with the other copyrighted work of all the other Linux copyright holders under GPL unless they agreed when they released to release the whole thing under GPL. It seems that they did because we downloaded it from SCO's website back in the beginning of last year after they filed their lawsuit, and we discovered that it was the canonical version and that it was released under GPL. So either one of two things were true. A, there are no SCO copyrights in it, in which case they're just distributing a vanilla GPL thing. Or B, there are SCO copyrighted things in the kernel named Linux, and it has been released to the world under GPL terms. If B is true, then SCO is in violation of GPL themselves by telling people they have to pay a separate license fee. GPL has this thing called Section 7, which says that if you were aware of other agreements that might supersede your right to distribute the software under GPL, i.e. that you are going to go out there and try to get licensing fees separately for the software that you've released under GPL in violation of GPL, then you are not permitted to distribute at all. So SCO is prohibited from distributing under GPL if, in fact, they hold copyrights in the work, because they're out trying to get extort licensing fees from various companies, including Daimler Chrysler and a whole host of others. So if SCO wants to say, yes, our copyright's in there, we're happy to say, great, you're in violation of GPL. And in fact, if you read IBM's counterclaim against SCO in the lawsuit, this is in fact the vanilla GPL argument that we make, that we helped them design, our legal team designed this way of thinking about GPL and the people who understand GPL. So that's where we sit. We don't know when the SCO issue is going to be resolved because it's a lawsuit and they take time. The only thing we know is that pretty much everybody, save IBM in case they did something wrong, is in perfect health with regard to GNU plus Linux systems. Because even if SCO does have those copyrights, they're in violation of GPL themselves, and your copy of GPL that you have distributed to you from SCO is enough to tell SCO to go away, I'm not paying you any licensing fees. So if your company gets a letter, just tell them that. You can look on our website, www.gnu.org/philosophy/SCO, if you want to read various papers written by our lawyer, Evan Moglen, on this issue, if you want to read more about our opinions regarding the SCO lawsuit. The key question that SCO has brought up for the community is echoing something that we've been saying for a long time. Initially, SCO was claiming it was the whole operating system, and eventually they narrowed their claims to the kernel. The reason they even have one iota of doubt with the kernel and can actually make any even vaguely plausible claim is because Linus, when he was constructing the kernel, didn't use the legal assembly process that the Foundation has used since we began the GNU project. The Foundation collects copyright assignments from every contributor. If that contributor is employed doing programming work of any kind, we require an employer disclaimer from their boss that says, we permit this person to assign these copyrights to you and hold no claim over it. For every piece of GNU software that is copyrighted by the Free Software Foundation, every line almost, there is a piece of paper sitting in the fireproof filing cabinet back in the offices in Boston that says where that code came from and what its legal pedigree is. We did this not because we wanted to be a pain in the ass to developers who want to contribute and make them have to sign wet signatures on paper forms, but because we knew that a SCO would eventually come. We didn't know that it would be SCO. We didn't know that it would take this form exactly, but we knew that someday people would come around and say, are you sure you don't have some of our software in there? With regard to the Foundation's copyrighted software, we can say, yes, we are sure. Yes, we know that every line of that code is copyrighted by the Foundation. We have a piece of paper to prove it. We wish Linus had used this process. There's a lot of cleanup work to be done in Linux, because even once we show that SCO doesn't hold any copyrights, it's still open to those kinds of claims because the legal pedigree is not certain, because patches have been accepted from everywhere and there's not a piece of paper to go with each one. We have a big job to do in our community to educate people how we've done this process of copyright assignment all these years. We have a big job to streamline it even better than it is now so that other organizations and other free software projects can do it without being too much of a burden to the developers or minimizing the burden to the developers. That is the aftermath of SCO. It has nothing to do with whether or not people are going to have to pay licensing fees to SCO. I will go out on a limb right now and give you wonderful odds that's not going to happen. Anybody wants to take a bet on it, I'll give you whatever odds you want. It's not going to happen. SCO is not going to get licensing fees from users of GNU plus Linux. But now that there has been a SCO, there will always be something like SCO out there questioning the legal pedigree of free software, and we have to educate the community about how to get the legal pedigree right. After all, Microsoft has toned down its rancor against us. Why? Because they went to SCO and, quote, bought a license, unquote, for this technology. Now, you've all used Microsoft systems, probably. You probably know that they don't seem to be based on Unix at all. In fact, we can't find a single Microsoft product that has Unix technology in it. Yet, Microsoft went around and spent multi-million dollars with SCO to, quote, buy a license, unquote. Microsoft, in fact, communicated with us that they had bought a license for some patents, undisclosed patent numbers, from SCO. We don't see SCO holding any patents on technology that's relevant to Microsoft. What we think Microsoft actually bought was not a license from SCO, although it was grafted into a license. What they bought was the cheapest PR they ever bought, and a lot cheaper than they already charged their PR people who came up with an un-American cancerous virus that eats software like a Pac-Man. They've got the best PR at rock-bottom prices against free software. That's why there's always going to be a SCO. Microsoft will continue to be buy PR against free software as long as it exists. Does anybody have any other questions? You have a, well, let me get him, he hasn't asked one yet.
Oh, as someone who is just kind of now starting to learn about like free software movement, what would you suggest a good starting point for kind of getting involved with it and kind of become part of the community?
The question is how to become part of the free software community. The interesting thing is, this is actually a question I'm usually getting from companies, not from individuals. And the funny thing, I often laugh when companies come to me and say, who do I talk to this free software community? And there's actually nobody to talk to. And there's everybody to talk to at the same time. If you want to get involved with free software, the best thing I suggest you do is find whatever project you like the most. Install a copy of GNU Plus Linux. You can get it from the Free Software Society or any of the other groups on campus that give away free copies, free as in beer and freedom, of GNU Plus Linux. Install it and play with the system for a while. Find the project that most interests you. Get its source code. It'll be there on the disk. And if not, there's a written offer for it that you can go back and get it. Or you can download it from their website. Take a look at the source code and see what it does. Find some feature that's not there and add the feature. Get on the mailing list and post to the mailing list and say, I added this feature, I want to get involved with the development. Be prepared to have your posts rejected. Be prepared to be told, we don't really need any more developers, or you know, we don't like the way you did it, or go away, or various other things. Be prepared to go back again in a couple of weeks and say, I really want to get this patch integrated. What do I need to do? Why you guys don't want this patch? What projects are there that I can work on within this software project that you guys actually want to see done? Where's the to-do list? Can I look at the to-do list and try to find something that I can help out with? Here are my skills. Build relationships with the people doing the work on the software. Read the mailing list every day and get involved. That's the simplest way if you want to become a free software developer. It requires a lot of personal initiative. The people who run the free software projects are the people who show up. There's a saying around that, you know, movements get started by people who show up. Things get changed by people who show up. The free software movement is no exception. You show up to a project and stay there a while, eventually you'll be somebody important in the project. I've never met a person who did that arduously for a few years and didn't end up a key developer in a project. Yeah, go ahead.
I guess my question is, I don't really see how companies make money, or how you can make any money off a livelihood doing free software.
Well, it's interesting because the way most of the money in the software industry is made is the same way it's done in free software. As I was saying before, companies who develop proprietary software usually are losing money on the licensing fees, and they're making their money on the support and service contracts that they give. It's only the biggest and most powerful companies who were there first and were able to get control of the market, like Microsoft and Oracle, that are able to make real money, really big money from licensing fees. Most of every small software company and many big ones are making most of their money from support and contract services. Look at IBM, for example, who now has $1 billion with a B division devoted to supporting free software. HP recently announced that all their server hardware is going to come with GNU Linux installed rather than other operating systems. Not too popular with the HP UX team, I'm sure. IBM's S390 system, which is their highest of the highest end mainframes, only comes with GNU Linux pre-installed. There's lots of people employed at IBM to work on all different aspects of GNU Plus Linux, and they're employed doing it because IBM's primarily trying to sell that big piece of hardware again. The hardware is becoming commoditized in the biggest way, more so than it ever was before. If you look on the side of embedded devices, one of the reasons that Windows CE was never successful was because the devices cost 10, 15, 20 cents to build. And the licensing fee back to Microsoft to run Wintz was 50, 60, 70 cents a copy. We're getting to the point where the zero marginal cost of hardware is really close. It's getting cheaper and cheaper to make the hardware, and the software is the expensive part. The licensing fees are the expensive parts. But people still need all the traditional things they need with software. They don't want to pay licensing fees anymore because consumers say, well, I don't want to pay more for the software than I did for the hardware. But they're willing to say, gee, if I want support, if I want service, if I want it in a box with a nice manual, if I want it if I want premier levels of service, I'm willing to pay for it. If you look at something like the GNU C compiler, which is these days the most premier compiler for the C and C++ languages. It's ported to more architectures than any other in the world. It's available for more platforms than any other in the world. There are dozens of companies that exist only to work on GCC. You take Cygnus, which was now gobbled up by Red Hat when they had a lot of money, which is one of the best decisions Red Hat ever made. Cygnus and the division of Cygnus within Red Hat now primarily does only support for the GNU compiler collection, GCC. And they were so booked in the mid and late 1990s that it was a two-year wait to get a Cygnus engineer to work on GCC for you. You called up Cygnus and said, I want to book engineering time. I want to pay you for it. They say, fine, 2 years, because there were so few people that knew GCC. In the intervening time, little companies like Code Sorcery, which is about a four-person company, started up supporting GCC. And there's still the big monolith in that space, Cygnus, which is now part of Red Hat, which is an even bigger monolith, at least in the context of that particular industry. But these smaller companies are able to compete because they don't charge as much, because they have lower overhead, and their engineers are sometimes not as knowledgeable as the engineers at Cygnus or Red Hat. There's IBM engineers employed to work on GCC because they need it for their S390 product. There's HP engineers because they use GCC on all their embedded platforms. So there's all these different people in the ecosystem working on this product all together, various different companies, because they all have a vested interest in seeing the product. The IBM and HPs of the world need it for themselves, internal use. The Code Sorceries and the Red Hats are providing service out to chip manufacturers who want it ported to a new chipset. Then you go to somebody who basically provides Rolls-Royce support for GCC, Monte Vista. They charge $15,000 a copy for GCC because their service package is so much better than all the others and so much more involved. I mean, they send people out on site and they do training and all this stuff. So they're sort of the Rolls Royce of support for GCC. And if you look at any large free software project, take Apache, take Samba, all these ones, they started out primarily as a little group of volunteers writing an interesting project. And once it became useful to companies, there were lots of opportunities for employment. I have never met someone who started a major free software project who isn't still employed years after working on it. Great example are the guys who wrote Samba, which is a file services for Windows machines running on a Unix-like system. So you can run a GNU Linux box and serve your Windows machines, and the Windows machines don't know they're talking to a free software operating system. It just serves the file SMB shares up for them. They wrote this project as an experiment when they were in graduate school. Once it became pretty stable, various companies started using it, and they started getting work improving it and supporting it. Now, there's hundreds upon hundreds of little independent people who do support for Samba and get employed to work on Samba. But if you want to pay the really big bucks, you can get the guys who originally wrote it, who know it best, to work for you. So there's lots of opportunities like that. It's a different industry. It won't be the industry of the monoliths anymore. It'll be the industry of the independent contractor and small companies rather than big giant ones. I think that's actually a better software industry. And that sector of the software industry, I think, has better jobs and better environments for people to work in. And the monoliths will still be there, primarily the hardware manufacturers who want free software to run on their hardware. So there's a lot of opportunities there. And right now, that sector, I mean, free software is a small piece of the pie at the moment. As the pie grows, that piece of the pie grows and there's more free software, there's going to be more jobs, not less. People always need experts. We still need, cars have been around for many, many decades, yet we still hire auto mechanics. We still have a competitive free market for auto mechanics. You can get the manual for your car and figure out how to fix various things, and in economic bad times, more people do their own oil changes and do their own work on their cars, but there's still a market for experts. It's like that in auto mechanics, it's like that in law, and it really ought to be that in software. I think that working as an expert and knowing more about the technology than someone else ought to be the way you get competitive edge in the marketplace for software, rather than, well, I wrote something once and I'm able to license it 1,000 times and never do work again and still make money off of it. Like I was saying, Microsoft still makes money off of Windows 3.1 and Windows 95 in the third world. They go around and extort money out of small places. I met a guy from Uruguay about a year ago at one of these talks at a university, Calvin College, out somewhere in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And he was working for a school in Uruguay when he was before he came to the United States to go to school. And this high school, they had the BSA show up and say, okay, all these versions of Windows 95 and Windows 3.1 that you're running, you got to pay us licensing fees for these. And I don't think that that's the way the software industry ought to work, that anytime you're running some old piece of software, they can come, the BSA can knock on your door and say, pay up your licensing fees that you didn't pay. The school, in the end, because he was there, switched to free software. And he got paid to help them switch to free software. So I think the way that the model works is different. It's not going to be the BSA knocking on people's door to collect licensing fees. It's going to be, we want to hire somebody here in-house to support our software. That's, I think, the business model of the future for free software and for the software industry as a whole.